beyond delighted to be joined today by Jeffrey Hollander, who's the Chief Inspired Protagonist, co-founder, and chairman for Seventh Generation, the leader in green household products. Jeffrey, thank you for joining us. I'm really excited to speak with you and to hear about your new book, which is called The Responsibility Revolution: How the Next Generation of Companies Will Win. So my goal for this—
Happy to be here.
Thank you. My goal for this interview is to go through your biography and talk about how you've developed as a leader and a teacher of social responsibility and sustainability. And along the way, we'll talk about some of the beliefs and some of the tactics and ideas that you present in your book. And you have a couple of other books out there already. So what made you— what's the purpose of this book? Why write another? What are you trying to accomplish?
Well, I think unfortunately, my experience as someone who has been passionate about corporate responsibility for over a decade or so was that the corporate responsibility movement had failed to fulfill its potential and to have what I view as a very necessary positive impact on our society. So the purpose of the book was to try to create a greater sense of urgency, to try to help people understand that this is an imperative, it's not an option, and in fact, there are more and more companies that are providing revolutionary change beyond the type of incremental change that characterizes the way in which most companies engage in corporate responsibility.
Before we get into your background quickly, you know, you are an inspiration for the business that you've built to so many of us, but what are you proudest about that you've accomplished through Seventh Generation?
Well, I reflect on two different things. If we think about the past year or so, one of the things that has been both wonderful and challenging is the number of people that have decided to follow in our footsteps and move their business in a more sustainable direction. And of course, that creates more and more and more competition. And you can look at that competition in two ways. You can say, you know, boy, that makes business a lot more difficult. Or you can take the perspective that if we fail to create competition, if we fail to get other businesses to move in this direction, we will really not have made much of a difference at all. So I am thrilled that so many businesses are moving in this direction and creating more and more direct competitors for Seventh Generation. The second thing that is probably the most fulfilling is how the business has had a positive impact on the lives of our employees and community members at Seventh Generation. And that is both a story of individual growth, it's a story of the result of ownership in the company that has allowed people to buy houses and send their kids to college. But we believe that perhaps one of the most important aspects of corporate responsibility is to allow people to fulfill their potential as human beings, and helping people along that journey is probably the thing that it causes me to want to get up and come into work every day.
So you had a couple of businesses in nonprofit businesses and professional development classes and adult education before you took on and co-founded Seventh Generation, which was in the late 1980s. What moved you to take this step into the consumer goods package industry?
Yeah, you know, the thing that has been the continuity to everything I've done is education. And Seventh Generation, as was the case of the other two businesses I started, is about education. Both educating other companies as well as educating our consumers. Because when you go into business like we do 22 years ago, selling something that no one knew they needed and no money to advertise it, the only way you can create demand for your product is to help people understand the underlying issues that make your products relevant. So I think that's the theme that has connected my career. But the other aspect is that, business is not just about making money. That's never been a motivation of mine. You know, making money is what happens when you do well what you're passionate about.
But why the consumer goods? Did you feel like, well, this is an interesting industry for me to try to educate people? Or what was it about that particular industry? Was it just an opportunity that popped up, and being an entrepreneur and someone who liked challenges and liked different vehicles to reach people, you took it, or was there something else?
Well, there's a couple of answers to that question. I mean, one, selling bathroom tissue and laundry detergent, we were selling a product that everybody could potentially purchase. And unlike the other corporate responsible companies that were, my peers, many of whom had a business model that they would build a successful business and then give money away, we wanted to create a business where the values of the company were embedded in the very products we sold, and that the more products we sold, the more we would extend that positive impact. Other than that, my dad worked in the advertising industry, and Procter & Gamble was his biggest client growing up, so maybe there was some unconscious exposure to household products.
So, and you, from the early days, and right here you just talked about it again, you felt that business had this untapped potential for doing good. This wasn't a very commonplace idea at that time, and it was riskier and more open to criticism than it was today. So what gave you that notion, and then how did you begin to implement that? Was it just gut? Was it instinct? Was it following your own values that you lived in your non-work life?
Yeah, I mean, to a large extent, as you said, I mean, you know, when we started 22 years ago, there was no roadmap. And much of what we call corporate responsibility today was just bringing our values that we live with at home into the workplace, behaving the same way we would at home at work. Treating people the same way we would treat our friends when we came into the office. Now, of course, we did have in Burlington, Ben and Jerry's around the corner and Gardner Supply and other companies that were great inspirations to us. But corporate responsibility was nowhere near as articulate and clear a path as it is today. Corporate responsibility meant buying recycled paper, but it didn't mean treating your employees well. And, you know, we from day one gave every single person we hired stock in the company. We did that just because we thought it was the right thing to do, not because it was a way to have other people think that we were a responsible business.
And you also felt that you had a conviction if you were a good and responsible company, the marketplace would reward you. And were you able to observe that in peer companies at the time, like you just mentioned Ben and Jerry's, or was this, because, you know, that was pretty anathema to the time, to the 1980s, and it's still a difficult, people still have trouble with that notion. So what gave you the confidence that could be true?
Well, I think that it really hasn't been until the last 10 years that we have the evidence to prove that. I mean, over the last 10 years, the company has grown an average of 30% a year for 10 years now. And I think part of that, particularly in light of a difficult economy and a lot of competition, is that the relationships that we formed with our consumers are not transactional relationships. We have something called the Seventh Generation Nation. We have about 350,000 members of the Seventh Generation Nation. The relationship that our customers and consumers have with us is a relationship that's not about buying bathroom tissue. It's really about, on the one hand, products that align with our consumers' values. And I think that, on the other hand, we give people an opportunity to feel good about the products they buy from us. They know that when they buy a product from Seventh Generation, whether it's what we're doing in Indonesia to build an industry of sustainably harvested palm oil, what we're doing in San Francisco by helping low-income Hispanic women set up cooperative businesses, that there is a whole world of good, if you like, that they are supporting when they buy our laundry detergent.
Mm-hmm. And you just mentioned the sustainable palm industry. One of the things that struck me in your book was you wrote about scaling business versus scaling impact. And one of your Seventh Generation's foremost goals is to bring the industry with you, to raise the industry to a higher standard. And you know, one example that you shared in the book was that you had a program called Show What's Inside, where you started to show the ingredients in all of your products. And then SC Johnson came up with just about the same name called What's Inside, and they did the same thing. And instead of feeling you know, threatened or slighted by that, you embraced it as saying, this is great. Now here is a, you know, one of these larger consumer product companies who is embracing this transparency, and that means that they're going to have to hold themselves to higher standards. So I just thought that that was interesting. It wasn't just about scaling your business. It was very much about scaling the impact, and that was taking risks as a pioneer to try to find sustainable palm resources and some other things that could be, they were risky. They could be shaky for your business at first, but the idea was to bring the industry up behind you.
Right. And I think that one of the exciting things that the book really articulates is it tells many stories like that of companies like Linden Labs that created Second Life doing really innovative things, proving that they can work, proving that they're good for business, with the hope that that real revolutionary innovation will spread and lift up the way we all do business.
That's, you know, what I like the examples that you chose in the companies because they were broad. They weren't just what we think of as sustainable or green companies. And the six principles of the book that you really talk about are mission, collaboration, transparency, authenticity, community, and consciousness. And in the example of Linden Labs, you talked about them with collaboration, and then you also brought in Etsy, the online company of handmade goods, to talk about community. And so these interesting ways that allow us to be more innovative, like you said, with our businesses. And one of the things that also impacted me was it seems that you talked about innovation as a way to bring sustainability along, and you gave examples of IBM and Nike that are in the book. And so it's not just sustainability for sustainability's sake, it's, you know, let's really be innovative. Can you share a little bit about how you feel about that and maybe how Seventh Generation has used the idea of innovation to bring along its sustainability?
Yeah, I mean, you know, sustainability has to be founded ultimately on a sound business case for why being sustainable is good for business. And in the competitive environment that we live in today, it is absolutely critical that we implement sustainability in innovative ways. And it's not the incremental, the cautious innovations that will win. It's the innovations that make great leaps forward. Now, those innovations can be social innovations. When you have a company like Linden Labs that lets every single employee in the company decide who gets bonuses and how much they get, and they throw out the whole notion that senior management knows who to reward and that the community is the best group in touch with employee performance, and they should provide and distribute those rewards. You know, that is a leading edge social innovation. And it is that kind of social innovation that sometimes we forget when we think about sustainability, because we often think about just the environmental dimension. You mentioned earlier palm oil. And palm oil is such an interesting thing because over a decade ago, we made the assumption that vegetable renewable resources were better than petroleum-based resources. And because we didn't really use a systems thinking lens to look at the full impact of palm oil, and we were not aware of how much palm oil was grown on plantations, we made a simplistic choice that was not the best choice. And then this past year became one of the first two companies in the United States to switch over completely to sustainable palm oil, and really tried to show the food industry, the cleaning industry. I mean, palm oil is in about 50% of every product that is sold in a supermarket. So it is pervasive, and it is that pervasiveness that is having such a catastrophic effect on the environment when the rainforest is burned down and plantations are put up. So innovation, if it's going to work and be sustainable, is a critical aspect of corporate responsibility. And of course you see very large companies like GE taking a stand in healthcare now after they followed in energy. And when you think about the position they're taking, they're betting tens of billions of dollars that these innovations in energy and healthcare will pay off with tens of billions of dollars of incremental sales.
Mm-hmm. So the U.S. in general seems to be getting a little jittery lately about the level of competition in our businesses. Feeling that maybe we're not as competitive as businesses in other countries. How do you see sustainability, let's taking that as a broad term, because you know the vernacular that we're using is still not perfect, but how do you see sustainability or social responsibility as being a competitive advantage for a business?
Yeah. You know, I mean, you were talking about the U.S. as a country. I mean, one of the challenges we face, and we face many of them, is that just like a company has to focus and specialize, if a company tries to do everything well, it'll fail. Well, the same is true of countries. In a global marketplace, countries have to focus and specialize. And if you think about China, China has chosen renewable energy as a place to focus. China now spends as much in 1 month on renewable energy as we in the United States invest in an entire year. So if U.S. is going to continue to be a leader and going to reap some of the benefits, we have to have a strategy. We have to say, these are the industries we're going to focus on. We're going to focus on them by building the educational capability, by building the infrastructure, and then helping those businesses become global leaders. Today, we don't have a strategy. Today, we have a strategy that is basically held hostage by the old economy, held hostage by oil and coal companies that are driving us towards a industrial policy that is not sustainable and has a very dim and limited future.
So it's using sustainability and particularly looking at resources and what we can do now to preemptively use less resources in the future that will give us the competitive advantage.
Yeah, and we have to do that not just in the global marketplace, but we have to do it in the local marketplace. We have to build strong local communities. Food, for example, is not something that should be globalized. We need to build local agriculture, local food sources. It is a national security risk to depend upon South America and China to get our food.
One of the things that I really admired in the book is that you talked about some of the struggles that seventh generation has had as you grew to find, to clarify your mission and to clarify your strategy and where you could fit in. And the question that you and your employees asked yourselves was, what does the world need most that we can best provide? I think a lot of businesses, as well as individuals, ask themselves this, but it's a harder question than it seems that it would be to find the answer to. So how did you, either personally or you as a leader of a company, come to this solution? And how can you counsel other individuals or businesses to figure out the answer of what they can best provide to the world?
Well, the process is a process that is both a sort of personal journey as well as a community dialogue. It is at the heart of creating a mission that really matters. It's at the heart of creating an environment where people really feel like they can come to work and make a difference. But it was a several-year process to really focus in on the difference we can make that is unique. And one of the things that we focused on is the whole idea of equity and justice. We see, to a large extent, that business is a vehicle to continually concentrate wealth in the hands of fewer people. And we felt that we as a business needed to both impact equity and justice as well as become a model for the possibility of equity and justice. It was something that there was both tremendous personal passion for at the company, and we believed that because we were willing to be so transparent, we could create a model that would inspire others to follow us. We were willing to do things like have a salary cap of 14-1. We were willing to ensure that everybody who worked for us was an owner of the company. And so it was a combination of clearly there is a need for greater equity and justice, but we felt that in some respects we were uniquely able to make a positive contribution, and then in some respects, if we didn't do it, we didn't know who was.
Mm-hmm. And the idea, the value of equity and justice was one of your values. It was a value of a predominance of employees at the company, and that's how it became one of the company's core values?
Yes, and I mean, if you look on my blog, I write 3 or 4 times a week a blog called InspiredProtagonist.com. You'll see that that's not an easy road. Over the past month, there's been a lot of internal dialogue and debate about, are we equitable enough? What is equitable enough? How should value created be divided between our employees and our outside investors? And we're still having lots of difficult and challenging conversations. I think what is unusual is that we have these conversations out in the public so that other businesses can read and hopefully learn from some of the challenges that we're struggling through.
Mm-hmm. We don't have so much time, so I'm not going to get into the transparency, but there's just a fabulous section of on transparency and trust in the book that I encourage people to learn from.
I'll give you one sentence on transparency,
please.
Which is, if you're not scared by what you're revealing, and you're not freaking your lawyer out by what you're revealing, then you're not being transparent enough.
You know, you make transparency sound like the beginning of love when you're a little bit scared, but you're drawn to it. You know it's the right thing to do. I like that. Do you think that, you also said that your movement, has our movement been co-opted? Has it lost its heart and soul? And what do you see as other brands like SE, Johnson & Company, and Clorox now have green products out on the market, and you're still a well-known manufacturer of these green products, but do you see your mission shifting as a company or as an individual leader?
Well, you know, A, we have to keep setting the bar higher. So what was good enough last year is not good enough this year. So we have to keep defining what is possible. We have to encourage companies that are doing the right thing, while at the same time, we challenge them to do more. You know, Walmart is an interesting example of a company that I have been both extremely critical of on numerous occasions, but acknowledge and support them when they take positive steps in the right directions. In a global sense, though, business is falling way, way, way short of what is required of it to slow some of the terrible challenges that our planet and our society is facing. So no matter how much I want to encourage the steps that people are taking, you know, my fundamental message here is we need a revolution. We need big, bold changes. Now is the time to take them. Now is the time that they will pay off, and that the companies that refuse to see that, the companies that pretend to do things that are not enough, I believe will suffer and will be left behind.
Can we teach true social responsibility or sustainability? I'm sure that we can teach tactics, and that's what your book does, but can we take a company who doesn't care about it, and even if we give them the business reasons, do you feel that we can teach them to be a truly sustainable company?
I think that in many cases, the desire and passion to do good is in our hearts somewhere. Many of us have lost it. Many of us have covered it over with other things. Many of us are scared to express that passion and that desire to do good. But if we can discover that inside ourselves, we can manifest it in the business. If it is just a tactic or a strategy, you'll fail. No employee wants to work for a company that wants to look like it cares if it doesn't really care. And when you're an employee, you can tell the difference in a second.
Mm-hmm. So here I am interviewing you, and I write a blog, and I work with some companies in the consulting capacity, but I'm not a business owner. What do we need from people like me and from myself to help this movement? What kind of role can the people who aren't leading companies and more of the independent people who necessarily aren't working for a company, what can we do?
Well, I think that, you know, there's a few things that are critical. I mean, one is, you know, keep looking for and promoting the success stories. People need to hear that this revolution is happening, is succeeding, so we need to celebrate and broadcast and repeat those successes. We need to help those companies, in many cases, build the business case for why they should do this. They need to understand why this is good for their business, so that they can dialogue with their managers and their owners. And in many cases, the capability of building that business is not available inside the company, and it takes an outsider to help create that. And lastly, we need to really hold people feet to the fire when they fall short. We need to really expect more than we expect. It's not enough, as we all know, for a company like Toyota to put out a great car like the Prius. That's just not enough. It's not enough if at the same time they're lobbying against higher fuel standards in California and they're turning their back on fundamental issues of safety within their own company. So we all are easily lulled sometimes by these initiatives that are highly compartmentalized and not systemic or holistic. And that's the last thing I'd say, which is sustainability is really a system of thinking. It's a system of doing business. We just started 90 days ago a sustainability institute to teach sustainability to large and small companies globally. And we start by talking about the sustainability mindset, because it starts by how you think. And if you don't think in a sustainable fashion, we will end up with all of the negative unintended consequences that are presenting such challenges to the world today.
Where can people find information on the Sustainability Institute? I'll put a link on that. Is it on 7th Generation?
Sure. Yes, or the website is called institutesustainability.com.
Okay, great. So I know that we've got to wrap up, but I wanted to ask one more. You inspire a lot of people to up their game. Who do you look for, and who pushes you to do better and to keep reaching?
You know, I'm inspired by a pretty eclectic group of people. You know, I'm inspired by people like Gandhi, who reminds me every day that I must be the change I wish to see in the world. So I'm inspired by historical figures. I'm inspired by many of the people that I wrote about in the book. You know, when people read the story of Linden Labs, they'll see a real trailblazer that is doing many things that we've yet to integrate in 7th Generation. George Simone, who runs Organic Valley, has built a $500 million company whose primary focus is to save and build family farms throughout America. So inspiration is everywhere. It's often not in the daily newspaper, but you know, you have to look for it. You have to look for those wonderful people, and they give me energy and they feed my passion, and you can't do this on your own.
Likewise. Well, I'm really pleased to speak with you. I look forward to sharing your story and getting people to read the other stories that you've talked about. And my absolutely final question is, who else do you know that I should interview? Whose stories should I get on cause capitalism and into the minds of these other entrepreneurs who are reading my work?
Well, I mean, you know, one of the things that I try to do in my own blog is highlight some of those stories. I mean, and some of them are well known. I mean, I love the story about the collaboration between the Grameen Bank and Danone Yogurt in Bangladesh. You know, that is a wonderful story with many, many lessons. I think that there's lots of things happening in the whole world of social capitalism, sort of the crossover between not-for-profit and for-profit businesses. This organization that we've been supporting out in San Francisco called Wages is an amazing example of, you know, low-income women working for $5 and $6 an hour, building the capacity to own and operate and very successfully run their own cooperative businesses. The stories are everywhere, and watch my blog, and I'll hopefully highlight some new ones from you every other week or so.
Okay, great. And if anyone else comes to mind, I'd love to write about them. Well, thank you. Thanks so much for your time and for the book that you put out with really tactical ideas, examples, and inspiration. And it really is, as you say throughout, it's a blueprint. So thank you for giving us something that we can work with.
Well, thank you for helping to build and support the movement, because it takes people like you to help spread the word. So pleasure speaking with you.